Hello and welcome to Pale Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on WildPost most... Elliot, drop the beat. Venison packed, antler racked, bullet impacted, title hacked, character jacked, pain racked, ransacked. You stopped the beat, Elliot.
No, it's still going, you just can't hear it.
Oh, I just can't hear it. Foundation cracked, contract enacted, lease compacted, fact backed, second acted, after packed. Huzzah! Work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
And we're coming at you live in the Discord, the only place where you can hear us talk for 20 minutes about random shit and look at pictures of dangerous theme parks. So if that sounds interesting to you, go to doofmedia.com/discord and join our live recordings.
Yeah, and happy 2023, mm-hmm. As we talked about briefly last week. We're keeping up the tradition of everything being an anniversary of something at the moment. It's now the anniversary of it being this year.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, happy new year, everybody. If you're in the new year listening to this, 2023, or later, you know, if you're a year behind the times and you're listening to this on New Year's Day 2024, an extra special happy new year to you.
Yeah, this is, you know, we're entering what is definitely 100% for sure the last year of the podcast. That's exciting.
We're here to talk today about Hard Pass 22.5. which is a chapter of Pale. Now, slow down, Ruben. I hear you saying, whoa, what's Pale? Well, I'm not going to explain that. Listen to last episode if you want more on that.
I forgot about that. Yeah, okay.
In 22.5, we're in Verona's head. Lucy and Verona are talking to Liz, and there's Abyssal soldiers fighting, and they're getting blasted. Liz is interested in hearing them out, but pretty reluctant to actually sign up to anything.
Huzzah. Liz,
that was
definitely
the last huzzah. That was
no, there's a new one.
Oh, okay.
Liz really has that energy, you know, of Mac from that episode of Always Sunny, where she's like, I'm playing both sides, so I always come out on top.
Definitely.
I
never thought I would say this about a character who is just the amalgam of people around her, but yeah, Liz just really goes with whatever the last person has said. Hey. Liz just
that about sums up.
Talks most recently, I think.
I think just saying yeah and then petering out kind of sums up how I feel about Liz as well. Like, it's so funny to me how clearly detached she is from, like, or the discrepancy between what she wants and what she really needs is just so vast. Like, she's talking about how great it will be to create this, like, backstabbing environment. She's like, oh, I thrive in stuff like that. And it's baffling.
Yeah, it makes me think, like, do you think Liz has more going on than what she's actually indicating? Because, like, she talks about how she thrives in backstabbing environments, but clearly she's the one getting backstabbed by either the Kenneteers, which is not really a backstab, it's a front stab, or Charles and Marcy. Like, she's not doing any double crossing.
I think she's just that stupid. I agree. I don't think, maybe it's because, you know, we've been seeing her next to fairy or not fairy at the moment or whatever, but like, she doesn't seem like a particularly adept social manipulator, which is like the vibe she's leaning into. She's like, yeah, I need this environment where I can be this subtle manipulator or whatever. Maybe it's just because we keep seeing her next to fairy, but I'm like, you're not even that good at that, Liz. Like, just stop.
Yeah, maybe she's just a bit of a doofus. Because she says, I like this new side of you, to Lucy, kind of talking about Lucy's willingness to go all out in the pursuit of justice. Which, yes, maybe this is an extension of that further than Lucy has gone before, but this is basically what Lucy's been about the whole time. Lucy's always kind of been a badass like this in the pursuit of justice. So, yeah, I don't know. Liz, you're a doofus.
Her whole reaction to, like, them torturing these kids and seeing the effect, and, like, Liz just turns around and she's like, oh, great idea. Like, you know, it's just like, oh, fuck's sake. Like, you can't argue with people like Liz. It reminded me of that time Musa was like, oh, Lucy, you sound like when the poor people think it's unfair that the rich have so much wealth. And it was just like, well, yeah, like, how do you argue with someone whose baseline is just so incredibly different to that? Like, it's just so funny that Liz sees them being like, like tortured in their dreams. And she's like, this is great. This is going to be really good for their character development.
Mm.
It's like, oh, you like, you can't. Yeah.
Mm. Mm. Yeah.
I also do like she joins the sort of chorus of voices who are saying that like part of the whole thing with Charles's camp is you need to be torn down. So, you know, you get brought low so you get built back up again.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, it continues to sadden me how much Charles seems to be retroactively desperate to make something good out of him being forsworn. Like, for all there is his cause and everything, there's just, yeah, that like that side to him that like needs there to have been a purpose to forswearing, because otherwise, like, I mean, it was just shit. Like, you know, there was not a purpose to his forswearing. It was just the system sucks and he got shat on by it, and that was stupid and unfair. But like trying to be like, oh, but it made me stronger and better, it's like, no, it didn't. Mariska being a fuckhead did that.
Mm.
Like, yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Like, I know that that's like a really cold take, but just like seeing it again from Liz, I was just like, man, Charles is so pitiable.
Yeah, he's that, like, he needs to believe that though, right? Like, he needs to believe that his forswearing was in service of something, because otherwise it's just too depressing.
Yeah, like, yeah. Yeah, it's just, yeah, sad. And then, like, the other thing that Liz brings up that I thought was funny is she's spruiking about how great this school she sets up is going to be.
Mm.
And she's like, yeah, Charles had Seth investigate, and there isn't a magic school out there with this kind of curriculum that has a god or a goddess at the disposal of the school like this. And my first instinct was like, do you think there's a reason for that, maybe? Like, just...
Yeah, well, this is interesting because Liz says at the disposal of the school, but what I think Liz, or the situation really is in a position of power over the school. You know what I mean? Because, well, like, yeah. Mr. What's-His-Face from the god that they brought in to do some healing and kind of co-teach a lesson at the Blue Heron, that was a god that was kind of at the disposal of the school, not fully, to but, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
No,
exactly. Like that's it's not like these schools don't have the ability to bring a god in for a bit. So it's like, yes. What she's really advertising here is basically there isn't a religious private practitioner school. And so, like, because obviously they're converting the Catholic school into this, so they're just like, like, you know, shifting the scales a bit. But it's just like I think that's kind of the point, is it's like, I just think a lot of practitioners don't want a religious education for their kids. Like, it's,
yeah, or more explicitly, yeah, practitioners don't want to send their kids to a place where they're going to be kind of manipulated or made to be in service of a different power. Like, and if there's a god that's in charge of a school, a god who is known for kind of taking influence over somebody, like growing influence over somebody, I wouldn't send my kid to that fucking school. Are you kidding me? What are you talking about? No way.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's funny because you say that, but like, there are, like, you know, religious schools here in Australia. So, and like, I know people who go to them whose families weren't religious, but if it was like the best, if it was the best school, they'd go there. So that has to sort of be a big chunk of their target demo. Interesting. Is like, kid, like, parents who will send their kid, like, if they have the best curriculum, there will be, you know, we've seen practitioner parents, there's no line they won't cross. Like, some of them would probably send some kids there. It's like, yeah, sure, they might get converted to this religion or whatever, but like, the power they'll gain.
Yeah, I suppose. And also the kind of, theoretically, if what Charles is trying to do isn't hypocritical, having a school that is open to people that aren't from huge practitioner families and can kind of build you up in exchange for getting some service to Marcy or Charles, kind of makes sense, I guess.
It's just funny how, like, whenever Charles is creating these systems to do the change in the world he wants, everything keeps funneling to Marcy. Like this just feels like the alarm bell. I feel like I've been ringing for a couple of arcs now, but it's like, it's the same. Like, he set up all these under cities because that ties into his whole like war on the seal kind of thing. But also, they're all kind of becoming more and more Mariska's. And, like, it's the same with this school. Like, he's setting up this school, and it still fits his agenda, but, like, the school will be seemingly explicitly part of Mariska's religion. So she's still getting a lot. Like, it's just funny how she's weaseled her way in. So everything that aligns with Charles's agenda and is helping to set up this great world he wants continues to empower and, like, help Mariska almost as much as it's doing that primary goal.
Mm,
Like, Charles seemingly either doesn't see that or doesn't give a shit. Like, he has this weird trust in her that, yeah, I don't know. Seems optimistic.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Very optimistic. Going back to Verona and Lucy in this interaction, there's some nice little bits of Tashit being Verona's BFF, or, you know, a good friend to Verona, which is just quite nice to see. It's always nice to see, like, Tashit so chill, good vibes.
Yeah, although the first thing Tashit says is that there's only one Verona, and so you could kind of gainsay her right from the get-go because she's literally been replaced as a familiar candidate by another Verona. So coming in pretty weak there, Tashlet.
Hush.
But I don't know that we did talk about Tashlet. Like, when Gillette first came up as like a familiar thing, I don't know. I genuinely don't remember how much we talked about Tashlet in that front, because Tashlet has just been out of the story for quite a while. And obviously, like, before Jules, Tashlet was kind of the familiar candidate number one from Verona's end.
First seed.
Yeah, so I think, like, it was just interesting to see Tashlet come up again and kind of consider, like, it was interesting to me seeing this moment, because, yeah, like, there were awkward bits around their familiarship, and it was a kind of a, oh, why don't we talk about it later sort of thing, and now it's kind of gone nowhere. And I think last week Lucy compared it to kind of the way her and Wallace have fizzled out as, you know, their relationship, like, the same thing's happening with Verona and Tashlet's friendship to a degree. And I guess I found that sort of idea interesting. I don't really have a point to this. I just thought it was really interesting to explore someone who's kind of a not as close anymore friend, because she's falling to the wayside as things are getting more and more hectic. Like, as Verona and Lucy are leaning into their can it below kind of vibes without Avery, it's sort of people like Tashlet are getting a little bit more pushed away, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I feel like, though, maybe not. I was just thinking, like, Canada has become a pretty dangerous place. Like, I feel Tashlet is pretty close to ditching Kennet.
And I think she says that, yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. Like, I don't think it's... I would rather Tashlet be safe and ditch Kennet than stick around and be in danger.
I guess it's just interesting to sort of... I find the effect that will have on sort of Verona or whatever kind of interesting. Same as Lucy and Wallace, like this idea of... It's really interesting seeing friendships that fizzle out, not because, just because, you know, as you're growing up, like, you just sort of, I mean, we kind of saw it with Verona and Lucy at times, right? Like, it's just life is pulling Verona and Tashlet kind of in different directions, and like how that affects the relationship, I find kind of fascinating. I don't know. I mean, also part of me was just like, it's a little concerning that in the chapter that ends with them being reminded that this is a war and they're potentially going to lose people on their side, suddenly Tashlet was being reintroduced as a really good friend of Verona's. So hopefully that's just a coincidence.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully. We'll see. I think there was we didn't pull this prediction out, did we? But there was a prediction in our Pale Predictor form this week of like, oh, hey, Tashlet's back, and also it seems like it's escalating and to the negatives, and Liz are going to go after people that our Kennedys care about, and Verona's been thinking it's her dad, but she doesn't really care about him that much, so who else could it be? Oh, Tashlet, hey, welcome back.
Yeah, if somebody's going to go after Verona's dad, it's going to be in a way that makes him more prominent, not less. Like, yeah, exactly. You don't hurt Brett. You make Brett more attached to Verona somehow. Like, yeah. You don't connection block, you connection encourage.
Hey, what about showing Brett to the house on Half Street?
Yeah, exactly. Like,
what a fucked move that would be. Like, hey, Brett, your daughter has a house. Here it is. Like, you know, I'll show you how to get there.
Yeah, like that would be the worst. That would be the worst thing you could do for Verona, 100%.
I shouldn't have said it. I hope Wildbo's not
doing it. Yeah, Wildbo couldn't possibly top that. But yeah, no, I guess it's just. I find myself super fascinated by these sorts of relationships that are fizzling out just because shit's happening, people are growing, there's other shit to do. Like, so it's not really a testament to Verona and Tashlet being less compatible. It's just, I don't know, yeah, shit happens.
Also,
I really enjoy the whole time this conversation's been going on. The thing going on in the background is like these undercity / abyssal soldiers just throwing themselves and like killing themselves over and over again to get more and more immune to Jabba. Like, just really fun set dressing / like it adds a background tension that like we do get little reminders every now and then that like in the background all these dudes are screaming and killing themselves over and over again to get stronger. Like,
yeah. Yeah, you're right, it's a good vibe. So yeah, Lucy and Verona kind of make a more tangible version of the offer to Liz, like, we'll give you a chance to get out of the way, and not even get out of the way, it's get on board or we will get you out of the way.
Yeah.
She's kind of not biting and ditches to go deal with the Blue Heron kids for a moment, because she thinks they don't have a chance. They don't have the time to actually focus on her with all the other shit going on.
Yeah, and because I it was either last arc or maybe the arc before, there was a bit where we had like a little Charles perspective. And Liz was like terrified that the Kenneteers were going to come after her, and that, because I remember Charles calmed her down by basically being like, "Don't worry, you don't write. You're way too weak for them to worry about."
Yeah.
But she was genuinely terrified of the idea that the Kenneteers would come after her. So she's either putting on a good face right now, or you know, is fairly confident that you know, with their strongest member gone, they don't write or something.
Yeah, it's should have taken the offer, Liz. I don't know. I love this quote from Lucy where she says, "You know what bothers me? So many damn people think they're the ones who are going to tough it out. They're the ones who'll make it through and be on top in the New World Order. You're going to make it where Edith failed, Liz." Oh, so good. Such a good, like, because this is what every single person they've been fighting recently has been saying, like, yes, it's all going to get fucked up for a bit, but then I'll be okay. And then I'll be on top. And, you know, hasn't worked out for anybody yet. All the way back to fucking Alexander, people have been saying that shit.
Yeah. Well, I think it's because there's like two sorts of things you can argue with here. Like, first of all, it doesn't have to be like that. It's only like that if you let it be. But that's like, you don't even need to try and break their brain that much by approaching it from that angle. Because it's just, there's also the like, if this is the way it needs to be or should be or whatever, it's like, how sure are you that it's going to be you? Like, yeah. I mean, I guess it's just good for Liz that she's just that much better than everyone else. She just is the top 1% competence.
Yeah. Sure. I guess is the response to that. So I don't think Liz is making very many good points here, but she does make one point that I think is good, which is, you know, Liz has been holding back from things like the hospital and all these kinds of things, right? But once Liz is gone, she says Charles will put in a stronger and more aggressive city spirit that's more of a guard dog / bulldog vibe. And yes, I think that's probably true. And we kind of, I don't know, like, while I'm sure Charles is spending a solid amount of power, it doesn't seem like he's run out yet the ability to create a other that would be much more of a nuisance to deal with than Liz.
Not him, like, Marisica will have the power to do that, right? Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's enough to, as I'm easily impressed to say in chat, like, that's not enough to let Liz fuck them over, but it is something to be worried about.
Yeah. I mean, so just like thinking about how Marisica kind of has the power, like, are we going to reach the point where Charles has to like ask Marisica for help with his debt? Because it's kind of hilarious that he's apparently struggling due to a lack of power because of, you know, the way they turned the alabaster or whatever. And Marisica seemingly isn't helping much or at all with that, because she has a lot of power now, right? Like, anyway, just still desperately searching for a way to pull those two out of each other's clutches. But yeah, no, I agree. I thought that was a really good point from Liz. That's like, it is worth considering that if they just get rid of her, he might put in someone worse. But I, you know, I'm like, this is Verona. She can probably find, like, I was instantly like, well, Liz replaced Ken, right? Like, can the Kenneteers replace Liz? I'm still kind of, the whole concept of being a city spirit, I don't fully kind of understand. Like, I got it when it was Ken, because he was the animus of the town. So, like, the kind of bi-directionality of it made sense, where it was like, you hurt Ken, you hurt the town, but also Ken is made up of the town. Like, it's the same with the Alabaster Assembly. It's like, they're literally constructed from the area. I get it. Whereas, like, when it's Liz, when somebody else comes in and makes themselves City Spirit, part of me's a bit like, how does that work on the whole, like, how does Liz affect Ken at kind of ambiently?
I kind of see it as similar to, like, becoming the Carmine, right? Of, like, you probably should have, or you're not going to last very long, a propensity for the type of thing that you're going to need to be doing, and it comes with a set of roles, but also comes with corresponding, you know, things that you have an overview of, but just on a slightly smaller scale, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's just interesting, because Liz doesn't seem to have been as subsumed by her roles. Like,
no, I think the others, power is lessened, but the responsibilities and, you know,
yeah,
thing is lessened correspondingly.
I mean, yeah, like, and then obviously the idea of, like, if the Kennedys want to get out and beat Charles to making someone else the City Spirit, like, who would it even be? Like, can they get Ken back? Do we want Ken back? Miss obviously has to be a contender, because she already kind of has a third. Make it Avery, trap her there. That would be funny.
That would be funny. Yep.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know either. I unless they have a plan to put someone else in place, I think it's going to be Charles invoking a City Spirit of Kennet, but one that is favorable to him.
Yeah. I mean, the other option is just that they discussed binding Liz. And honestly, this is like one of those times where I think making the argument for binding her and just, like, straight up old school practitioner forcing her to do certain things might actually be arguably the right thing to do. Like, it will feel so dirty to bind someone and force them to do things for the Kennedys to do that. But, like, in the current situation, as a temporary measure, I think you can make the case that the Kennedys doing that with Liz is somewhat justifiable.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, as a kind of, yeah, temporary, like, if you're not going to leave, you're going to have to do it the right way. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll have to see. I don't know enough about it to really be like, this is how it would go, you know?
Yeah, I think this is really fun, because since Ken was first introduced, we've heard so much about how city, province, whatever spirits are this weird kind of vulnerability, and now we're going to really explore that, but not from the side I expected. Like, the fact that it's the Kenneteers as the aggressors in their hometown is a really fun way to kind of explore what it means. Like we see Liz get shot and how that corresponds with, like, whole bunch of shit in the town just kind of breaking. I guess it's going to be really fun to see more of that. This is not how I would have expected the city spirit vulnerability thing to be explored, and it's such a fun way to do it.
So yeah, Liz comes back and more tangibly refuses their offer. So the Kentians do a great, well, hold on, I've just got one more thing to say to you, attack, and blast her. but yeah, you know, this wounds her and kicks off, I guess, another front of this war.
Yeah, Verona, I think, thinks on it a bit later, and she's sort of like, man, things are really escalating now. As fun as it is watching these two, as Lucy kind of announced earlier in the arc, like, lean into their Kennet below sort of sides and really get into it, we're also kind of seeing some of the shortcomings of that, where it's like, oh, we're fighting a lot more people now, quite openly. As a reader, I fucking love it, though. I really enjoy the Kenneteers saying no to Liz's offer to be neutral. Like, Liz, she sort of comes in, because she doesn't full-on refuse their offer. She's like, counter-offer. What if I'm just neutral? And then it's fine, and everybody wins. And it took me back to when the Kenneteers discussed neutrality with Bristow and Alexander, because they claimed they were neutral in Bristow versus Alexander, but then they kind of ended up not necessarily taking a side, but still being involved in the conflict, because they stepped in when somebody was doing something wrong. And, like, I love that we see that sort of consistency from them here, where Liz tries to do the bad form of neutrality that, like, they were specifically fighting against in Arc 7. Like, Liz is like, oh, I'll be neutral, so everyone can just do terrible things around me.
Yeah, and as Verona thinks, like, then that neutrality will fall apart as soon as it's convenient to Liz.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that's, like, I just think it was fun, like, seeing the Kennedys shoot down exactly the kind of neutrality they were shooting down quick math, 15 arcs ago.
I'm kind of excited for a City Magic villain, you know what I mean? Like,
yes,
because there hasn't been, when we had Ken in the story and when we've seen City Magic in Thunder Bay and stuff, it's always been so cool and one of the coolest types of magic, but we haven't really seen much time when Liz is, or City Magic is actively being used against the Kenneteers, with the exception of the one thing that happened in Summer Break where there was a fake wall that came down and then Charles got to saunter into the contest.
And the thing later this chapter too, but that's like, they're very small, isolated incidents.
Yeah, but they're so cool. Like, I'm so on board for this more actively because it is just so much fun. Like, yeah. In the same way, like, you know, Vista in Worm was so fun because it was like space manipulation vibe. I just think it's going to be really cool as a threat. Different, but also very cool to see.
Yeah. Well, and I also think as like the Kenneteers and like Lucy in particular have been kind of building these relationships with the town and like with the mayor, like I think as well as just the cool ass city magic, it's going to hopefully be really fun to see the actual ties they've been making with the town maybe start to override Liz's claim a bit. Like, I think that would be a really fun way to start to take her down, is like, you know, like she technically represents the town, but like the Kenneteers are actually tied to it in meaningful ways. And I hope that that's part of their victory.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I hope so.
I just wanted to call out, there's a line from Lucy where, when they start like full on fighting her, Lucy says, "You talked about being brought low and fighting your way back up. Well, we're offering the fight. How sure are you that you're going to come out ahead?" Mm. And I just, 10 out of 10 threat. Like, that's one of those Lucy lines where you just want to like write it down in a book. It's so good.
Mm. Yeah, Lucy's really firing on all cylinders this chapter, hey?
Yeah, is she the best Kenneteer, or was it Avery who won that? I can't remember who won. Who's legally the best Kenneteer? It's Avery. Okay, well, never mind. I won't say anything then.
The gang heads off to plan for their impending war with Miss, and Verona has a chance to reminisce about the good times with her dear old dad.
Yeah. I mean, it's healthy to cry, Ruben, and that's what Brett was doing. He was expressing himself.
Yeah,
that's
very healthy, yeah.
You know, he's fighting back against toxic masculine stereotypes.
Yeah, great point, Elliot. Great point. You know what? Brett is a modern-day male hero, actually.
Yeah, this is positive masculinity.
Yeah. We need...
Sorry, no.
Just imagine I'm doing clap emojis between each word here. We need more Bretts.
Before we get too deep into the Brett stuff, something that got pointed out that I wanted to quickly jump back on. When Liz comes back to them, she takes the form of like that's influenced by the dog tags.
Mm.
As a doppelganger, she couldn't do others. I'm pretty sure that was like a whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So presumably, if she can emulate the dog tags, that's coming from her as a city spirit, which means the dog tags count as part of the city. So that's nice.
Mm.
Like, obviously, the others being part of city spirits has been dubious in the past. So I was
Yeah. They've put in their hard yards to defend Kennet from, you know, from Liz, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Back to this Verona memory. Yeah. Obviously, this is very depressing, the memory of Verona and her dad and, like, us seeing, like, the physical distance that is put between Verona and her dad. Mirroring the emotional distance and kind of seeing the history of exactly how that happened through this flashback and Verona's reflection on it. But it's interesting to note, like, this whole sequence is triggered by her leaning against a door. Like, that's enough to set her down this quite dark memory path. And it's effectively like a PTSD flashback being triggered by this, by just leaning against a door. It's quite a simple trigger that leads her down quite a dark memory sequence, which is pretty rough for old Verona.
Yeah, but I think like it's one of those moments where you can really feel the character growth because she like takes this in, feels it, and converts it to something productive, whereas like you can see 10, 11 arcs ago, it would have caused a bit of a emotional spiral.
Mm.
I think it is... important to know that, like, yeah, as you said, like, Verona's still at the point where something simple like that can trigger her down that kind of thought path, but she's able to pull herself out of it and turn it into something useful, like, which I feel like is a good sort of therapy. Like, I think that's more realistic than just, and now Verona's better and things don't remind her of the bad things. So, like, it feels more realistic that it's like the way you grow past that kind of trauma isn't necessarily to not be affected by it, but to be able to, like, handle it better.
Mm. Yeah.
And especially because I think what was really interesting about the way Verona turns this into, like, an actionable thing that kind of helps her read the room is it's like, in the comparison she's drawing, like, Miss is the old Verona and her and Lucy are kind of the Bretts, right? Mm. Like, Miss is the one who's maintaining her distance because, but, like, I guess my vibe is if this comparison holds, essentially what Verona is noticing is that, like, Miss is just getting a bit sick of how it's just constant fighting and, like, constant, like, you know, Kennet Found has kind of been, whether she wants it to or not, become the base of this resistance against the rest of Kennet.
Mm.
And I can see how, for somebody who set up their demiurgic domain kind of against their rule, their will, or not against their will, but, you know, like, she wasn't particularly keen for it. She felt like she had to do it. She set up this place. She made it a no fighting place. And now it's become kind of a hub for a war. Like,
You would feel a bit, put out by it, wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah. Like, it's a very understand. And we saw a little bit of this when she had that conversation with Lucy at the start of the sword moot too, where, like, she's seemingly, this is getting to her a lot more. Like, yes, I think when she was her old self, she was very nimble and, like had a vision. And now that she's got this compromised version of that vision and the fight is, like, worse than ever, a part of me almost thinks it's really starting to get to Miss. Like, I kind of almost want a Miss interlude just because I think these little signs we're seeing from her chat with Verona here and her chat with Lucy 5 or 6 chapters ago, like, yeah, like, Miss got stuck. Now she's got stuff to lose. Like, I think the thing to keep in mind is, like, if Miss is kind of pulling back a little bit on being willing to get into the fight, it's because she's now got this, like, she is responsible for Kennet Found. Like, if Charles came up to Miss and offered her, like, a peace treaty, she has to consider it more than she would have had to in the past, right? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. Like, I guess starting to get these little vibes that maybe Miss is turning into that sort of person where, you know, now that she's got a house and a home and a family and stuff and she needs to protect it, she's a little bit less willing to put it all on the line. And that's a super interesting change for her. Like, cause I can't really blame her and I don't think she's, like, that bad. Like, she still probably fucking hates Charles, but, like, the stakes have changed for her. Yeah, it's not quite like somebody becoming conservative as they get older and get a house, but it's not like that. Like, she's got stuff to lose now, and that might change some things. And I think that's, yeah, especially with Rook potentially being the ambassador Charles could send from his side, her old friend. Like, I don't know.
I hope this is not going to happen, but you're right. It could, I don't know. It could, I guess.
I have enough faith in Miss that she wouldn't fully turn coat because it just feels so antithetical. Like, she's the one who set this whole fucking thing up.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. It would be pretty wild.
But, like, I think there's just that little seed of doubt or whatever now, and I think that would be really interesting to explore.
Mm.
Especially, like, yeah, as Rook is kind of coming at it from the other side and their old friendship. I'd love to see a kind of conference between the two of them.
Mm. Yeah.
Something else to bring up, obviously something that is in the background of this whole chapter is, like, Verona kind of regularly has intrusive Avery related thoughts and always has to, like, be like, no, we're not thinking about that. And I think we saw some similar stuff with Lucy. And it's like, it reminds me of, you know, in arc 21, the underlying tension throughout the entire arc was that the Kenneteers were homesick and they hated that, like, they were on the run.
Mm.
And this arc's equivalent is seemingly just every now and then both Kenneteers are reminded of the fact that Avery is fucking wherever the fuck. And it's this fun, like, you know, as we're kind of finally fighting the culprits and, you know, this is sort of the final phase of the story for sure, 100%. Like, these are really fun ways to really increase that ambient tension. Like, constantly reminding both us and the Kenneteers every now and then that just like, we still don't know what's up with Avery. Like, it just makes you a little bit upset every time you see it. And I love that.
Yeah. Where is Avery? What's going on?
It's so funny that they've like, because they've taken this policy of like, well, we can't do anything about Avery right now. No one can find her. So we'll focus on the other problems. And it's just like, poor, like, part of me is like, it's going to be so funny if Avery's sitting somewhere waiting for them to help her, because this is fucking the start of the story for her all over again. Is her parents had, there were more pressing crises with her siblings, so her parents didn't give her the attention and she just fell under the radar. And so that's what I think it's going to be, the opposite of that. I think this is like, it'll be a great character moment for Avery, because this is the thing, is now that was to her strength, hopefully. Like, I'm hoping Lucy's right and Avery's doing some crazy shit in the background and is about to drop down with a nuke. But it's such a funny mirror to the start of the story that Avery has been the thing where it's like, oh, we know that's a problem, but there's nothing we can do about it right now and there's other shit to do, so we'll focus on that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure she's fine. I think I put out a prediction about this week, so talk about it a little bit more soon.
Because like last week, I think we talked about the idea that she could still be in the Abyss, whereas I think there was a line in the chapter this week that pretty much hard confirms that isn't it, or if it is, there's some extra shit going on.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. I feel like I've thrown I've thrown all the spaghetti at the wall that I can possibly think of. So if I haven't hit the nail on the head, I'm not gonna.
Yeah. But yes. So we now get to the part of the chapter where they start going after the Negateers again. Starting with Cameron, they head to Cameron's house with Blank Shanks, who sneaks in and puts down a phone with some incriminating photos. Sorry, yeah. Let me reread that line, shall I? At Cameron's house, the sexy stud Blank Shanks seeds a phone with some incriminating photos. There you go.
This is great. Oh yes, thank you for accepting my new addition to that line.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah, Blank Shanks is one of those characters I never expected to see Blank Shanks again, but he came back in. And I was like, oh, this is great. I forgot this guy's a little fuck. I hate him. I love him. Like,
yeah,
this is. Always with these other verse stories, is there's like a bajillion characters, and Wildbo can just bring one in, and I'll be like, oh, I forgot about this guy. He's great.
Yeah, he is very fun. It's a very fun scene, isn't it? Blank Shanks is delightful. This angle that they're taking to get at Cameron is hilarious and so like drama filled. It gives me like vibes of like a more messed up version of a teen sitcom, like seeding a phone to make somebody think that their partner's cheating, or make somebody's mother think that their partner is no good to get them to break up as an attack vector. It's like ridiculous. I love it.
Yeah, like dark high school musical. It's so beautifully benign. Like, it's so funny that like with Harry, they're like touching on horrifying. With Adrian, it's like, losing your mind to the Abyss. And with Cameron, it's like your mum found pictures of your boyfriend's phone. And similar, I think there's a mention in the next section that they've attacked Teddy too, and he had the benign dream, so I assume it was very similar. They just attacked Teddy's like civilian life. But yeah, I don't know. There's something so funny about like this vector of attack just being like a planted phone.
Yeah. It is very funny. And of course, a great shout out here to Juliet messing with Verona by making her think that she's a hardcore furry. It's good stuff.
She says she was messing with her, but like, do you...
Sure.
Do you believe it? I feel like I got the vibe that was covering based on the poor reaction it received. And it was like, maybe she was playing it up a little bit, but like, I don't think she would have said it unless there was a little something in there.
Yeah.
I mean, Juliet is much more of a cat than Verona. So it was like, I don't know. I'm not willing to rule out that there was a genuine side to it.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I trust that Juliet's telling the truth about messing, but who knows?
Yeah, because that's what Verona always does, right? I don't know. I just thought this was funny because I remember early in the story, Verona having that like a little bit of a chip on her shoulder that I've seen like artist friends in real life have, where it's kind of like, like, because there's so much money to be had in furry art that it's like you got to kind of actively distance yourself from being associated with furry art. And so this is such a this was like a funny way for that like demon to rear its head again for Verona, is like, just like, you know, Gillette would probably happily do furry art for people. And that, like, that obviously touches on like those sorts of requests Verona could get. So it was funny seeing her sort of continue to slowly lose this war against people not thinking that she's furry compatible.
Hey, yeah, Verona's, does this, should we be worried about Verona here? How close is Verona to dying here?
Oh, yeah, because we got to, like, it seems like she came real fucking close. I assume you're talking about the bit where she jumps the fence, lands in the water.
Yeah.
It's, like, minus a bajillion outside, so yeah. She gets, like, pretty quickly. I couldn't tell how much of it was, like, a frostbitey thing versus just, like, general self-weakness, but, yeah. Like, she gets really fucked up here.
Yeah, and basically is saved by some Kennet found citizens, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Not so much by Blankshanks. He kind of fucks off to get help, and I don't know that we see him again.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It's worrying.
Azusa did it, points out, she didn't even get shot once, though. So, yeah. You know, people have had worse recently.
Yeah, true. But so, yeah, next up they go to Harry's house to fuck with Harry. And finally, we see a Negateer give in. They got one. Boom. Ding, ding, ding. Jackpot. They got one. Hey. Finally, they got one. Other than Nomi, right? It was Nomi.
Yeah, who left with Yiyun.
But yeah, they finally got one. Probably so, another one with Adrian.
Yeah, there were the kids who backed out during the sword moot.
Sure.
I'd count those as a win.
Do we get their names even? I don't know.
Oh, I think we did, but I can't keep track of them.
Yeah.
I do think there's a point to be made for, like, the problem is the more Negateers or Red Herring kids who drop out, the more, like, extreme the group becomes, right? Like, as you keep culling away, the softer
size
of it. And I mean, but this is exactly what's just happened with the Kenneteers. You take Avery out and it gets more warlike because you've only got Lucy and Verona left, and they're essentially doing that same kind of natural selection on the enemy team. Every person who's good enough to drop out just means that the people like Kirilin kind of have more power, and it's
Kirilin gets more and more unhinged. This is the thing.
Yeah, you continue, and I mean, like, I'm not really saying this as a criticism of how the duo is going about it, because I don't know that it's avoidable.
Yeah,
if you try to do this thing where you let the good people go, but it's like this interesting side effect of doing things a right way is the more chance you give for the like normalizing people to drop out, the more extreme the group is going to get on average. And as we potentially head into seeing the effects of their first counterattack, it's like something to keep in mind is, like, both sides are getting more bloody as their more tempering sides get cut out.
Yeah. But it's nice to get some wins here. Some, like, I don't know, kindness wins. Do you call them kindness wins? I don't know. Like, it's I kind of did want to see them actually horrify Harry a bit, but I'm glad that they're being nice and giving these poor kids an out. Harry, probably Adrian, Cameron and Teddy have been messed with, and I don't know, might also be getting out, but it's just kind of a nice way to end the chapter.
Yeah, yeah. Although, again, I feel like it also leaves us on this ominous note of Verona remembering grandfather's quote about how in war you just hope the other side is more miserable than you are, and we're going to see their counterattack, and that's going to be pretty heartbreaking, I imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't kind of wait to see it. Like, it already feels so tense in this story, and if the Kenneteers are actually going to start suffering losses, it's been a long time in this story since I feel like we really, like, you know, we had those moments in Summer Break where we lost people like John, and haven't been many of those, and I'm worried we're about to have those sorts of moments again. And Breastbiter. So remember when we lost Breastbiter?
Yeah, that was a dark day. Oh, I didn't even mention it when it came up, but we've lost Stu Mullen as well, which is pretty sad.
Oh yeah, I did feel for you. I read that one. I was like, oh, poor Ruben.
It's sad times. Anyway, well, no, he's just retired. But
he'll be back once everything calms down. He's just taking a nice holiday. Anywho, that's the end of our chapter for this week. But it's not the end of our episode because we have some predictions that have been left in our Power Predictor spreadsheet, or I have pulled out a prediction at least that I want to talk about, which is from Propaganda Pagoda, who has predicted that Avery is spending Arc 22 as an audience member with the Aurum. They made a bet on how Lucy and Verena would act, and Avery and the Aurum are watching this bet unfold as part of an ongoing contest. The Aurum has shielded away Avery, and that's why Avery cannot be found right now.
Yeah, and a big part of why I really like this prediction is I think we discussed the potential of the Aurum or Sable having Avery in one of those connection blocking cages.
Yes.
Back when this first came up, but I had absolutely no idea what reason there could be for them to do that. Yep. So I like Propaganda Pagoda is a genius for coming up with a reason that I'm like, well, if that's true, that would actually be a good reason to have done something like this.
Mm.
Like, because the judges' boxes that block connections, I feel like one of the few things so kind of could be with Avery, but there was never a reason for them to have one of those around her. I would encourage Propaganda Pagoda. I think hedge your bets. I think the Sable being the other person or being the person with her in the box is actually also a thing, especially considering she was maybe in the process of dying. Like, I think that could be a really fun spin on the whole play a game with death sort of vibe.
So, I
like this idea that Avery has presented some kind of challenge and has been disappeared because that's an aspect of the challenge. That's a really fun idea.
Yeah, I really like that. I think it's pretty clear that something is shielding Avery from being found now, right? It's not just a place, but it's an active person. And I think it could be worse if it's Marcy, but this is an interesting one that will, I think, be really narratively satisfying if it's true.
Yeah, I agree.
Mm.
I wanted to highlight a conversation that happened in the Reddit thread for the chapter. It was kind of kicked off by Banshee Wales, but they essentially were pointing out that, like, Liz had that coyote mask in this segment, and there were talks about, like, the imagery behind her having a coyote mask, because obviously when she emulated all three Kenneteers in Arc 9, she had the rabbit mask. And so it's like, okay, now that it's just Verona and Lucy, she had the coyote mask, and it's like, were the dog tags influencing this too? Or... like, is that what, like, Verona and Lucy's mask represents just without Avery? Like, you know, it's like if you add a deer, a fox, and a cat, you get a rabbit. But if you add just a fox and a cat, you get a coyote.
Mm.
And then, like, I think there was Zarathustra 30 was a user who tried to then maybe predict what some of the other combos could be. Like, if you had just the cat and the deer, so no Lucy, you might get a squirrel. If you had just the fox and the deer, you might get a bear, which is one I didn't fully understand. I thought this was a really fun idea. Like, there's a lot of fun room to play with Lissa's masks as different combos of the Kenneteers.
Yeah, I like that. I think that's a really fun area of discussion. Hey, speaking of fun areas of discussion, we ran a discussion question this week. Our discussion question was about what rituals and symbolism would you put into your blood-based or other religion. I think the big learning from this one was religion has a lot of magic blood imagery. I mean, I guess I'm specifically thinking of like Christianity, which was called out a lot here, you know, communion, the body and blood of Christ, you know, your little wafers and your wine, your little church snacks. But yeah, a lot of blood imagery. Actually, fun fact, tying it back to what we talked about before we started recording, I forgot there's a scene in Bruges about, you know, the holy blood that is dried but then kind of becomes wet. Like, blood imagery is in religion.
Yeah, and that's one of those things where, like, I just never thought about it. But, like, as you said, reading these answers, you're like, oh, yeah, like, especially, like, Christian stuff, there's fucking blood everywhere. And, I mean, like, a lot of people specifically lent into some Catholic stuff for this, which, like, I think, you know, is not just representative maybe like the demographic who listens here having familiarity with that, but also just like obviously Charles and Marisica have been leaning heavily into a kind of inverted Jesus and Mother Mary image. Like, we've talked about that before, So I thought it was really fun that people kind of tried to emulate them. And it's like, okay, well, if I was doing my own twisted version of Catholicism, what would I do?
So yeah, Beleg Tal talked about and gave an example of some very ominous religious music to do with blood, which I think was fun. A great example of the way that blood already exists within religion. I also really liked Sengachi's answer, which was along also existing religious lines of like a blood communion, but from everyone putting in blood into a communion, you know, collection plate, and then everyone kind of drinking this blood as a way to sacrifice yourself to the collective, but then kind of join the collective through a shared power source of everybody's self. Great way to bond as a cult and a great way to transmit disease, but I liked it as a symbol.
Well, you know, if one of us is sick, we are all sick, right? Yeah, and like Beleg Tal specifically in a sub comment under this brought up that like this was a fun inversion of like the, you know, the blood of Christ, like Eucharist stuff, which, yeah, like fits in with that whole anti-Catholicism thing that Charles and Mariska kind of have going. So, yeah, I thought that was fun. I'm assuming that we're going to save this one for last. So I'll jump on Propaganda Pagoda. I had like a great one kind of detailing like an array of blood oathy sort of things and like how they could like just sort of a bunch of like blood magic ideas that would center around this religion thing. It was really cool.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not doing it justice.
Yeah. I think Propaganda Pagoda and another one, Landis 963, both talked about like blood, the conception of the like a blood oath, you know, like making blood pacts as a way to kind of add additional oomph to your vows. I also really liked from Propaganda Pagoda's answer also talked about blood banking as a way to like bank your power for later. And then when you're injured or your self is low, you're kind of leaning on this blood bank.
Because that's what, like, that's the thing that, like, cyclists do, right?
Yes. So this is what Propaganda Pagoda said was taking a leaf out of Lance Armstrong's book.
Yes,
I didn't really understand that. I should have looked it up, but that makes sense.
I've heard about it before. It's like they take blood, and I think, like, you know, they only store some parts of it, like the platelets, some of the shit that's, like, energy stuff, but then, like, yeah, when they're in, the middle of one of these tours, they can basically inject themselves with their old blood again to help, you know, recover or get a boost. So it's exactly, it's blood banking. It's setting some stuff aside earlier so that you can use it later.
Should we talk about Vice Versa's answer then?
Yeah,
because it was wonderful. This was one, maybe one of my favorite discussion question answers we've ever had. Vice Versa talked about the idea of, rather than blood, a cult based around hair and the imagery of hair that could be used to build kind of rituals and symbols into it. And I just thought it was like Vice Versa gave a really in-depth and detailed discussion question answer here, and it was genuinely so good. It was so clever and so, like, it had such a nice internal consistency in the way that great systems do.
Yeah, this is very much one of those go read it for yourself answers, because we can't do it justice. But I was like reading this, I was like, oh, you can tell that Vice Versa is active in places like OMO and does this sort of thing regularly, because it was so good. Like she touched on so many like aspects of like hair imagery and how it fits in with the crown. So she like tied it into like otherverse specific lore and stuff too. It was really cool.
Yeah, really good stuff. So we'll definitely recommend checking that discussion question answer out.
Yeah. Would you join the hair cult?
The past 2 to 3 years of my life has been me joining the hair cult, Elliot, as my hair has grown longer and longer. So yes, is the answer. No, I was thinking about this as well, but like, I really do love the idea of, like, and I think this was something that existed in like Viking culture, right? Would be like braided beards or hair that had specific meanings based on the beads that you had in your beards or whatever. Like I'm, you know, misremembering a Wikipedia article, so obviously don't take what I'm saying as a source of truth, but I'm pretty sure that was something that existed in Viking culture, was
sounds right.
Meaning imparted into braided beards and hair. Or maybe some like Norse cultural thing. But anyway, enough about hair, for God's sake. We've got a new discussion question to talk about.
Sorry, just quickly, last minute chat. Any other alternatives? Go on once.
Nope.
Go on so twice. Anybody got it?
Taking after Juliet from this chapter, our discussion question this week is, which animal are you most attracted to besides humans? So obviously leave your answer to that discussion question.
You haven't thought this through, Ruben. We're going to have to read those answers and then talk about them.
Well, I don't understand. It's just a normal thing to talk about, as Juliet has said. So you can leave your answers to that discussion question in the discussion thread on Reddit.
Or don't.
Just as a quick note, let's keep it safe for work, folks. But yeah.
Ow.
Or I guess like, I don't know, spoiler tag, anything more extreme. But yeah, your discussion thread is linked in the show notes down below, so leave your discussion answers there.
Or don't.
Apologies to everyone on the Parahuman subreddit this week. And yeah, if you want to review our podcast negatively, I understand. You can do that in your podcatcher of choice. Leave your reviews there.
Yeah, don't forget to check out our Twitter as well. It's going to be less cursed than our Reddit this week.
And that's
nice.
Yeah. It's rare that Twitter gets to be less cursed these days, isn't it? But hey, maybe for once. If you want to find out more about the Doof Media Network, you can go to doofmedia.com to find out all the great shows on the network. As I said earlier, as I said at the top of the show, but I'll say it here as well, you can also head to doofmedia.com/discord if you want to join in with our live recordings, because they're quite fun, and it's always fun to have an audience here to just kind of shoot the shit with while we record and before and after.
Yeah, and there's a lot of fun discussion that goes on that is hard to call out, but yes, like it's happening in the background, and I'm like, we're reading it. It's just hard to interrupt the flow, but it's really fun watching the conversations go on as we're sort of talking.
Yeah. If you want to support the Doof Media Network and all the great shows on the network, I don't know why you would after this discussion question, but you can by going to patreon.com/doofmedia and becoming a patron.
You don't get to act like this discussion question is awful.
I'm excited.
You made it happen.
Elliot, you and I and Georgia are recording a series at the moment about the Jurassic Park, Lost World, Jurassic World series of films. And it's been very, very fun. So I would encourage people to become a patron at the lowest tier, and then you'll get access to the bonus feed with all the kind of bonus shows that we do, including The High Ground, which is that one that I'm talking about. So
yeah. And we'll be doing a special episode of that in a handful of days, actually, which I'm excited for, about the new Shrek movie that just came out.
Yes, I'm so excited to go see Puss in Boots 2, The Last Wish, or whatever the title of that film is.
Something like that.
So if you want to get access to that very special episode when we do it, you can subscribe to the feed on Patreon.
Yep. And don't forget to stop by Wildbo's Patreon, patreon.com/Wildbo. Stop being neutral. You're like Liz if you're not donating to him. That's mm-hmm. neutrality, and we don't take that here.
We don't take
the Kennedys, right, and donate to Wildbo.
I mean, people are asking us to answer the discussion question. I have an answer, Elliot. There is I think an objectively correct answer, and it's actually quite fortuitous that we're talking about it now, that this is our discussion question this week, because it's also related to something that we're going to be doing this week.
I shudder to think.
Do you want to give your answer first, Elliot? What animal are you most attracted to besides humans?
Can we save this for next week? Because these are going to be the only two answers. If things go well, if the universe aligns right, it's just going to be us talking about it. And that's
right. So we'll save it for next week. Which is that I think there's an objectively correct answer to which animal is you're most attracted to. And maybe people think it's a cop-out, but I'm going to call it later. All right, well, and if that's not a teaser for next week's episode, I don't know what is. So catch you next week, everybody, for our best episode yet.